Hello and welcome. This is Jesse Canone, and you are about to listen to one of my Live Pain-Free expert interviews, where I interview the leading health, fitness, medical, and healing experts in the world, true pioneers who are doing amazing things. So I'm bringing to you, without a doubt, the most powerful information that exists in the world today on how you can dramatically improve the health of your entire being, mind, body, and spirit. And this is true breakthrough information that you will likely never hear about on television, online, in magazines or newspapers, and certainly not from your doctor. So if you'd like to finally eliminate those nagging aches, pains, and injuries, if you'd like to have more energy, if you'd like to boost your immune system and prevent sickness and disease, or if you want to reverse and cure yourself of a current health condition, then sit back, relax your body, open your mind, and get ready to receive some powerful information that is going to change your life. Hello and welcome. Jesse Canone here from Live Pain Free. And today I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Todd Bourne. Dr. Bourne is a naturopathic physician, certified nutrition specialist, and regularly lectures at medical conferences and appears in media around the world. I asked Dr. Bourne to be my guest today because he's an expert at dealing with complex chronic diseases and pain. As a naturopathic physician and doctor, he prefers an integrated and more holistic approach than you'll typically see or get from traditional doctors. So Dr. Bourne, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join me.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm excited about chatting with you. You've got such a wide depth of experience. You know, I was rereading and revisiting your bio in preparation for our call, and I had forgotten just how much you've had your hands in and how much you've been studying and learning and practicing. And so I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Great. Thank you.
Why don't we start with, before we kind of dive into our topic, which is, again, how to deal with complex health issues, you know, whether it's a disease or a pain condition. Before we do that, why don't you give us, if you would, please, just a brief kind of background. How did you get into, you know, natural medicine, and a brief snapshot of your journey?
Sure. There are a number of doctors in my family, and I was always kind of interested in medicine. When I was growing up and in high school, actually, I thought I was going to be an astronomer, and then that was my original major in undergrad, was physics and astronomy. And I wanted to go into the field of astrobiology, which was, it's in a new emerging field even as this day. And then I met with one of my physics professors who used to teach at one of like the three or four schools in the U.S. that has an astrobiology program, and she kind of basically told me really candidly what needs to be done to be an astrobiologist. And at the time, you know, she's like, you got to at least have a PhD. Then you have to have a postdoc. And unless you want to sit in front of a radio screen and look at SETI, the SETI program, and read waves, you want to be in a telescope. And those are very coveted positions. And so at the time, you know, I'm like 19 years old. Like, that's a long haul for what may never even be. I was like, well, I do like medicine, so I'll just go back to studying medicine. And that's basically what I did, was a pre-med major, essentially. And then I had complete plans to go to conventional medical school. And my father, actually, when I was living in Taiwan and teaching, he came down with esophageal cancer. And then I came in 2003, and I returned after a year in Taiwan. And his prognosis was not great. And I was kind of getting interested in some of the natural medicines anyway. It just made more sense to me than just straight pharmacotherapy. So I started talking to some of the doctors in my family, emergency room physician, family practice. And I really didn't even know what a naturopathic doctor was or natural medicine. So they actually all said to me, you know, if you really want to be able to help people, you should become a naturopathic doctor. And so I started exploring the universities and what it took to get in, which since I was pre-med, I already had all the prerequisites and the GPA, et cetera. So I enrolled, went through all those things, and then I completed my residency at Ambassador University in Seattle, Washington, in the 13 teaching clinics. But I also did rotations in two emergency departments and a Swedish hospital's Department of Integrative and Family Medicine. And I was in Virginia Mason's Department of Physical Rehabilitation. And that kind of got me into, you know, there's really got to be both, right? If you really want to be handling complex patients, which most people are, right? Most people don't have acute illnesses, and those are pretty readily treatable by inpatient, outpatient medicine. But most of the United States, people suffer from chronic disease, which conventional medicine, you know, I'm not knocking conventional medicine. I use it. I prescribe medicines when necessary with more judicial use than some of my MD colleagues, but they don't have many answers. It's just straight up pharmacotherapy, maybe some PT. And there's a reason that people have become sicker and disingenuine and disenfranchised by conventional medicine. There's a reason more and more people are moving to movements like functional medicine, integrative medicine, naturopathic medicine, kind of all under the same really umbrella, same philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just to back up for a second. So PT meaning physical therapy for those who might not know the acronyms.
Yeah. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, and that's kind of the standard protocol. Well, you just go physical therapy for a number of weeks and hope that helps. If not, there's pain meds, and it just doesn't help people.
Right, yeah. And then I wanted to go back, if before we kind of go any further, you mentioned your interest in the astrobiology. Just briefly, like, what is astrobiology?
So astrobiology is a field that is very subspecialized, where these are individuals that actually look into the universe and try to find origins of life. And so they were interested in me, they as in graduate programs, because most people who go into astrobiology, they have physics degrees or mathematics or something like that, or chemistry. Mm-hmm. Not many have a biology background. So like, you should stick with your biology degree because you're more likely to get accepted, because you, as a biology major, you understand, say, the chemical soup needed to form life. And that's astrobiology got to get fulfill all my passions, because I got to be essentially an astronomer, but really look at origins of life. But then, of course, had the reality check of how long the road was to, that final destination.
Yeah, so it sounds like looking through the microscope out into the outer space, looking for elements of life.
Yep, and trying to figure out probabilities also where there most likely would be life, whether it's going to be, you know, distant planets, stars, and then working with chemists or even having a strong chemistry background and say, okay, you know, most likely life would form here, and you still get to stare at the stars all day and, or I should say all night, and it would have been nice. But I was very content with the path that the universe had for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I can see why you're interested in that. I have a curious mind, so that sounds fascinating. So coming back then to your journey, as I mentioned at the beginning, you've kind of studied and done quite a bit in your career. One of the things that I've noticed is people who have a wide variety or depth of experience generally, not always, but generally tend to be the people who will put together more holistic approaches, and holistic solutions to problems. What would you say in terms of the bulk of humans, as you said, especially in Western civilization, like here in the United States, where we're dealing with lots of chronic health issues? First, what do you feel is the, or what are the biggest kind of underlying factors? Why are we in the situation that we're in?
That's the $1 million question, right? We can talk for hours about that.
Right.
Theories and why, and as far as chronic disease. Well, there's this kind of adage in medicine that genetics loads the gun and environment pulls the trigger. So typically, in most cases, of course, you have sporadic cases of, say, ankylosing spondylitis or an autoimmune disease or cancer. But for the most part, typically the individual has to have some kind of genetic propensity or, predisposition to get a condition. So, for example, in ankylosing spondylitis, which is an autoimmune disease that causes widespread chronic pain, if you have skeletal predominant disease where it affects, say, your spine, you can get fusion over time of your vertebrae, that there are a pretty large amount of evidence that there's some kind of trigger to that, and that trigger tends to be an infection. Klebsiella pneumoniae, say, is one of them. But why would person A end up with ankylosing spondylitis who gets that infection, and person B not? Right. Usually there has to be some kind of genetic predisposition to set that cascade in motion. So that's certainly one cause. There's a mounting evidence that toxicants, chemicals that are toxic to the body, because there's a difference between toxins and toxicants. A lot of people use them interchangeably, but it's not so. So just, I can be pedantic with certain terminology, but toxins are something that the body actually produces, whether, like say someone has a C. difficile infection. That is a normal bacteria that lives in your gastrointestinal tract, but then it can release a toxin, or it's a metabolic byproduct. A toxicant is a chemical in our environment that causes problems to the human host. Lead, for example, is a toxicant. Pollutants. In the Environmental Protection Agency, there are over 88,000 chemicals that are registered with the United States Environmental Protection Agency. Of less than 1% have actually been tested on humans. Most of them are just rat studies. And so if they got proof that it was safe in a rat, then it's okay in a human. The other way that these chemicals can be released in the United States is the company is not responsible for what happens with what the body physiologically and metabolically does that chemical. So if they can prove a chemical is safe, it's not their problem with what the body, say the liver and the metabolites through detoxification, as the body's trying to detoxify it. If that becomes, say, carcinogenic, for example, which happens with a number of chemicals, that's not the company's problem, unfortunately, even though we may know that that substance is, I'll give an example, like if someone wants to use a petroleum candle and they light it on fire, it creates benzene rings. Those are carcinogenic, but the candle itself is not. It's what your body does with that and basically through those metabolic processes so you can get away with them. Right. So I think chemical exposure, genetic predisposition, certainly infections as we're seeing more and more, cancer, autoimmune disease, et cetera, there's more and more evidence shedding light that it's being caused by an infection. Other parameters would be just the fact that we also, because of modern medicine, right, we live a lot longer than we used to. So we have now this ability to get sicker as we age, which is sad. When if someone's in their 80s, what quality of life is it if they're bound to a wheelchair and someone's having to change their diapers all the time and food feeding them, you know, baby food? That's right. Not how we want people to live. But modern medicine has enabled people to live a very long time, sometimes even if they don't want to live, right? It's the families that want to keep them around. Even though the person you say at the end of their life, they're like, you know, I've lived a great life, I'm happy, I'm ready to go. And a lot of times the family who has the, you know, the directive is like, no, we, you know, so who are you keeping that person around? So kind of the summation of that is that it's really a multifaceted thing of layers of why we're getting sicker and sicker, more, especially more easily.
Yeah, you made several great points there. One of the things I wanted to mention about the toxicity with all the chemicals that you mentioned, the other thing that I've heard said, and it totally makes sense, is there's also no research done, or very little, if any, done that shows you the cascading effect when multiple of these chemicals are introduced into the body at the same time. So it's not just how does the substance affect the body, it's how does the substance affect the body when these other 8 things are also present, or these other 25 chemicals are also present. And then you had mentioned something too I wanted to touch on a little bit more, and that was modern medicine keeping people alive longer. But I wonder, is that even why we're living longer? Are humans really living to 70, 80, 90 years old now, and they didn't hundreds of years ago because of modern medicine? I mean, I hear that all the time, but when I look at it, I don't know that I see that as the actual reason.
Sure. Those are good points. And to your former point is that in medicine, we actually call that toxic load, how much someone is succumbed to. You know, I speak to conventional medical colleagues or, you know, I'm at a conference speaking and, you know, we talk about detoxification. Is it really necessary? And, you know, skeptics will always say, well, you know, we have a liver, we have kidneys, we have lungs, and, you know, they're doing their job. That's true, but we haven't evolved long enough with these toxicants in our environment to handle what you just mentioned, 8, 10, 100 chemicals, pollution. There are studies even in Mexico City, for example, where there's so much pollution that they're actually seeing signs of Alzheimer's disease in children, you know, that early in life. Yeah, it's really quite sad. Wow. And if you look at these, you know, quote unquote clean cultures, like certain islands in Japan and certain, you know, Tibetan cultures, there's a lot of instances like this. These people live, it's kind of Linus Pauling Institute, you know, instead of lifespan, they call it health span. And these people have wonderful health spans and they are living into their 90s on average. And look at the United States. We are actually the only industrialized nation now. We are actually are going down in, you know, back a number of years ago, right? It was what males lived on average about 78 years. Women are around 79 or 80. It's actually going down now. Mm-hmm. So people are dying sooner rather than later. So that would be certainly a point against modern medicine's ability to keep people alive longer.
Yeah, because I've often, you know, I've heard that a lot and I've often wondered, like, how true is that? I mean, I see there's obviously some examples where medicine can take somebody who would have died of a disease, say, early in life, you know, it can save them and keep them alive. But that's not nearly as common as, you know, what we see more of, which is modern medicine kills people. You know, like somebody gets hooked on the, you know, the opioids and, you know, they get sick and they die, or they're on all sorts of cocktail of medications and they die due to
that or negligence or unnecessary surgeries and so on. So I do wonder, yeah. And yeah, like you said, we could talk about this for hours, but I do wonder what is contributing to people living longer and then what is contributing to the decline, as you said, that's starting to happen too.
Right. Well, you always see these things on like the news, you know, the expose shows or like they'll interview a bunch of nanogenarians, you know, or centenarians and they're, you know, people in their hundreds are like, what have you done to live long? And everybody's always got their trick. Like I remember when I was, for some reason, when I was a child, there was someone on the Johnny Carson show. Why? I remember this, no idea. And I think it's just because it was so amusing to me. I was a kid and this guy was like 110 or something. And they were like, what do you do? And so he said, I drink a teaspoon of Worcestershire sauce every day. And that was his, you know, thing. And you see this a lot, but I would think generally speaking, at least in, say, if you look at science, right, there are a number of factors that we know that increase all causes of life. And that would be exercise, positive mood, mm-hmm. vitamin D, adequate vitamin D, not too much, not too little, green tea, and exercise. So if you look across the research, that is what has been proven over and over and over to make people live longer. And that's generally when you see these people live a long life and they're being interviewed and they're just like, I love life. I love my family. I've got 50 million children and grandchildren and they're just happy as could be. Sometimes the curmudgeons, just because they're so stubborn, right, they're going to live a long time too because they're going to hold on to life forever. Right. But generally it's the positive attitude. Cleaner living, right? We know smoking isn't good for you, but yet people still do it. We know, you know, right. pumping yourself full of chemicals aren't great. Life in moderation is a big thing, right? You know, studies show that, you know, too much alcohol is detriment, but a small amount can decrease rates of dementia and certain cancers and lower blood pressure and cardiovascular disease. But mm-hmm. it's everything in moderation. And, you know, I think Americans generally are getting wind of that because they don't want to be decrepit in their golden years. They want to live longer. And so, you know, hopefully they're taking more steps in that direction.
Yeah, I remember one of the stories I heard a man interviewed also was, I think, 103 or 105. And he was in the UK and they asked him what he did to be healthy and live as long as he did. And I think, I forget the exact words, but it was like a pint of Guinness a day, you know, a cigar, and I think he said he did some boxing or something like that. So a form of exercise. But yeah, it's one thing that I think medicine doesn't understand at all and account for is two things. But the first being, I don't know if you want to call it karma or if you don't believe in that random chance. But yeah, there's some people like that, again, who can live 105 years drinking a pint of Guinness and smoking a cigar every day. Whereas another person, if they do that, they could die at 50, right? Yep. And so I think medicine, because they can't explain it, they pretend it doesn't exist, but there's something there. Again, they might try to say it's, you know, DNA. And I would argue that, you know, there's probably the ability to prove even through DNA comparisons of people who live long versus short lives and their behavior throughout their lives, that even that could also not explain it all.
Yeah, there's a movement in, well, not this movement, it's been around for a long time, right? Back in probably the 90s, it was the Sirtuin gene, and everybody was all about the French paradox, right? How can the French smoke cigarettes, eat so much cheese, and drink so much red wine, and they live much longer than Americans, and they also have a lot healthier light health span than Americans?
Right.
And then they were like, well, it's got to be the resveratrol in the wine because it's activating the sirtuin gene, which is the anti-aging gene, as well as lengthening telomeres. And then they tried to make it a drug and it ended up ultimately failing because no one wanted to pay for a resveratrol drug for a zillion dollars when you can get it as a supplement.
Right.
But yeah, there's certainly it's, and then, you know, the merit, I think human nature is just has a tendency to be very reductionistic and say, this is it. This is what does it. And that's not the way it works.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, reductionist, very much the approach. The other thing I was going to mention, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with it, but it's the epigenetic research. So, you know, you mentioned the DNA several times earlier in our conversation, and I've done several interviews now over the years with people about epigenetics and how the DNA gets expressed based on your environment. And I don't mean just your physical environment, but your whole environment as a being. So your emotional state, your mental state, you know, your physical environment, all that, what you eat. Within that is the passing down of trauma through generations. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with that work, but that's fascinating to see where people are more predisposed to have particular issues, and not just health issues, but even like, say, emotional and psychological issues, because they were passed down through a family lineage.
Yeah, there's actually, like, for example, dementia, there's some studies showing that if you can do the right things in utero, you know, you can actually, and this is across the board with a lot of conditions like atopic disease, like asthma or eczema or allergies. It's what you actually can do to mommy while she's carrying the baby to decrease all of those issues. If on the mental health sphere, if you will, is if say the wife, you know, which again, shame on the United States, is that we're the only industrialized nation that offers no mandatory paid paternity and maternity leave. You're expected to basically work right up until you give labor, and right. then 6 weeks later return back to work. You may or may not have job security depending on the state that you're in, and right. you may or may, you know, the Federal Medical Leave Act, the FMLA, it's 12 weeks unpaid. You know, that's ridiculous. I mean, how can you – most people can't go right. – they can't live off of that. So what we see is that if you can keep mama – you know, as stress as low as possible, and, you know, whether it's acupuncture, mind, body, breathing, yoga, at certain adaptogens, which are, you know, adaptogenic herbs that are botanicals that help with the body's ability to cope with any kind of onslaught, you know, particularly stress. That's what an adaptogen is, right? Helps your body adapt in a more positive and constructive manner. Babies, you know, tend to come out with milder temperaments. And I have a number of patients that have certain mental health issues and, or behavior issues or both, and they will talk to me. You know, you say, when did you start knowing these? What about family history? And it's very rarely does somebody come to me. Now it's a little bit of different, right, with the whole political climate and COVID. This is a different ball game. But mm-hmm. before all of this, most people that came to me with, you know, severe anxiety disorders or depression or, you know, whatever, we go back to the beginning and they would talk mm-hmm. about trauma, multiple traumas, or, you know, what happened to their mom, what happened to their grandma or grandfather. And so mm-hmm. I do believe that there's certainly aspects, right, they get imprinted in our DNA, mm-hmm. and it gets transferred from generation to generation. That's kind of the basis on a lot of these Alexander technique and Rolfing, really the somatic release of people getting to deep-seated trauma that they may not even have cognitive awareness of.
Mm-hmm. Actually, and something you said earlier about the pregnant woman and kind of preparing her for a healthy birth reminds me of something one of my friends, Dr. Robert Thompson, said a while back, and he focuses a lot on minerals. And he talked about how important it is for a woman before she even gets pregnant to get her body ready for pregnancy and having her mineral levels tested and, you know, finding what's out of balance, working to get the body balanced, which totally makes sense. But it's not the way most people create babies. I know it's not the way I did it. If I could go back in time, I would do it very differently. Not only would I incorporate that health kind of planning into it, but the whole thing would have been much more conscious and intentional and ceremonial, if you will, even. To kind of create the ultimate environment and atmosphere for, you know, for the creation of the child and then the birth of the child and, of course, the, you know, the raising of the child. But what I'd like to do is ask, you mentioned a bunch of things, you know, about why people are suffering with so much chronic health conditions. Is there one particular one that you think is, you know, more often a culprit or a couple, or is it you think more the collective effect of so many different factors?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, it's for me when I see patients, it depends what they're coming in for, whether if it's a chronic disease, right? And it's mm-hmm. typically refractory or difficult to treat, hasn't responded to anything, or maybe they don't even have a diagnosis, right? It's just this like, in medicine, when something's called a syndrome, you know, irritable right. bowel syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, the reason when someone gets lumped into a syndrome is because it's a cluster of symptoms for which there really is not a well understood mechanism or cause. So that's like, well, you probably, maybe that's just chronic right. fatigue syndrome. Maybe that's just fibromyalgia. You know, maybe it's this. So for me, it's, you know, a detailed history, right? And I have the advantage in my practice, and I do that on purpose, is that my first appointment's typically, unless it's a child, it's about an hour. And it's because I'm going to be very thorough. And I've been accused of that many times of my thoroughness, mm-hmm. which I think is a good thing. I like my own physicians yeah. to be thorough. But it's a big history. So if someone's coming to me, whether it's an autoimmune disease or it's something nebulous, just a bunch of – they're very sick and no one knows why, I need to elucidate potential causations. And that's also the biomedical mind of me with what's called, you know, differential diagnoses. So when someone's coming in and they're relating their story to you, which is also a gift in itself, right? I mean, it's a very sacred thing for someone – to come and spill the most personal things really about them, mm-hmm. right, and what's sure. going on, and that probably nobody else even knows, or maybe just one other person knows. And I give them that space of an hour or 45 minutes or whatever it is. I mean, I give them as long as they need, but typically it's about an hour. And then the follow-ups are always 30, 45 minutes versus conventional medical doctors. And these are colleagues and friends of mine. They hate it. They hate having 7 minutes and feeling like they're rushed to the next room and just mm-hmm. it's ill to the pill. But they're like, I have a friend, for example, he's an integrative medicine doctor at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he runs the Department of Integrative Medicine, which they've slowly gotten away with because it's not profitable. Because instead of him seeing people every 7 minutes, he's got 30 and 45 minute appointments. They're like, you need to see more people quicker. Right. Because we're basically losing money because, you know, that's the way the insurance game works. It can't be based on time, but for the most part, you know, it's a lot better in business for you to be coding moderate complexity ICD-10 or CPT codes, you know, which is the procedure code for how long you were with someone, what you did, because insurance is going to pay that. And if you do 30 of those a day versus 10 of those a day, who do you think, if you're working for a large institution, what they want from you? So for me, I take that time and I want to know everything that's going on. And then it's really digging into their history. Then that kind of whittles my big, you know, picture of what's going on to down to just a handful. I've been practicing medicine long enough where I pretty much have a good idea that it's going to be a handful of these things and then some pinpoint questions. And then, you know, when I used to have a physical practice, now it's all telehealth and has been for the last 2.5 years. Between history, physical exam, and then running pertinent blood tests, stool tests, you know, diagnostic imaging like X-ray, MRI, I pretty much know what's going on. I get the diagnosis, and then I know what to treat. So I really need to know, like, if someone's coming in and they have chronic pain, for example, well, what kind of chronic pain is it? You know, what makes it better, worse? What's the cause? When did it start? Is it nociceptive pain? Is it neurological pain? Is it compressive mechanical pain? Like you got in a car mm-hmm. accident, you have, you know, I need to know, is it infectious? Do you have a tick-borne illness? Do you have an autoimmune disease? I mean, I've seen so many people that they've never even were worked up for an autoimmune disease because it was the beginning stages. They didn't have big swollen hot joints. So no one ever even thought they might have rheumatoid arthritis because they're also young.
And
it's an easy test.
And, you know, it goes back to what you said a moment ago, which I wanted to kind of highlight and emphasize, is the whole medical system, you know, the kind of traditional medical system, the way it works with the insurance, like you said, it's designed for profitability. It's not designed for optimal results for the patient. So as a result, you're right. So many people go for help. They get their 5 minutes and they get their prescription and they leave. And of course, it's not going to solve the problem because they didn't do enough digging to figure out what's really going on, most likely to begin with. Then they gave them a symptomatic prescription, which might cause more trouble than it even helps, if it helps at all. And so it's no wonder why people have conditions that become chronic, because even though they are making an effort to try to deal with the problem earlier, or even very early in some cases, they're not getting the ideal results that they could have gotten if they had a more holistic approach from the beginning.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's sad, you know, and everybody knows it. I mean, the general public knows it. Hospitals knows it. You know, the conventional medical, everybody knows the American medical system is very, very broken. And it's sad for that. And it's very expensive. And part of the problem is, and I will keep pointing at the insurance companies because they are mostly to blame in a lot of this. Because, for example, when insurance pays very well for procedures, they don't pay very well for time. So it's not in a doctor's best interest to spend a lot of time with you, but it is in their best interest to do procedures and do things because you get more money. And I'll give you an example. When I was rotating through the emergency department, there was a child that came in, he fell off the monkey bars and cut his scalp, and he needed some stitches. So the attending physician went to the parents and said, you know, we can use biodegradable or medical grade glue because your son's hair is long enough. And I basically make sutures out of your son's hair. I glue it together and the glue comes out in about 10 days. And studies have consistently shown that there's less rates of infection, less need for antibiotics, and less need for better healing because you're using the body's natural method. You're literally using the hair to tie the scalp together. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And then when we walked out, And he offered the parents, do you want me to sew up your kid or you want me to do this? They were like, do that. So when we walked out and he said, you know what the disgusting thing of that is? I said, no. He said, insurance will not pay for what I just did. They'll pay for the office visit, right? The emergency room visit. But because I didn't actually get out the sutures, you know, and I sewed them up, they won't cover the glue, even though outcomes and studies show that it's better than the sutures.
Right, like, yeah.
They will not pay for that, and the hospital won't even bill for it. And that was just some eye-opening stuff. And we've got hundreds of thousands of examples of that where it's just – it's a very broken system, and so doctors just can't spend the time like they used to. Psychiatrists, same thing. They don't – they're just purely medication management. They don't – it's hard to find a psychiatrist that does – the
right.
things that they used to with the talk therapies and, you know, the guided imagery, et cetera. Now it's just mostly medication.
Right,
management.
Pills. Yeah.
Yep.
And you know, it's like many things, medicine is no different. You know, it gets to a point, it's so broken, but it's so big and there's so much momentum behind it. And there's so many powerful people who have significant impact on it and our ability to, you know, change it and or their ability to kind of make change difficult. That it's like people start to look for the alternative, which is what we've been seeing, you know, with alternative medicine getting bigger and bigger. And like, for instance, the nutritional supplement industry, which is, you know, it's great that people are like, all right, well, medicines are dangerous. I get that. You know, my traditional doctors, you know, failed me. I'm going to seek out this alternative care. The downside is, in my opinion, that a lot of the alternative treatments, it's all fractured. You know, you've got this camp, you've got this camp, you've got this group and that group and so on. They're not very well organized. And as a result, a lot of people are navigating, you know, trying to navigate their health, you know, either on their own, they're taking supplements they don't need, or maybe they're taking supplements that they shouldn't be taking for their situation, but they don't really know. So there's this movement towards more self-responsibility and self-care, which is great, but there's not a lot of education. And again, what does exist, it's scattered all over the place. I guess my point is there's not this like organization behind alternative care. And I feel like that's one of the things that would really help the movement and make it easier for people to transition from the traditional modern medicine to more of a natural approach.
Yeah. Yeah. In my world, it's a lot of Dr. Google. Right. People
right.
coming in and I don't blame them. They're trying
right.
to get
mm-hmm.
answers because they haven't gotten any and they're sick. And some people do get, just like what you said, they get very pigeonholed. I had a patient 2 days ago. She's actually a doctor herself, but she just doesn't want to. It's hard to treat yourself when you have a chronic
sure.
disease. So she has Sjogren's and she has been seeing, you know, dermatology for a while, and she's been seeing, you know, all these people, and they're just like, well, you kind of just wait for it to get better, or you can just do this, you can do that. And they were like, oh, well, that the hyperpigmentation, the darkening your skin, they're like, well, we can just give you a lightening cream for that. She's like, right, but what am I going to do about this disease process that's going mm-hmm. on in my body? Or I had another patient who, oh, she saw a neurologist, rheumatologist, internal medicine, and an integrative medical doctor for the past, I guess it's almost a year and a half now, for debilitating fatigue. And she's 24 years old. And so she heard me speak at this conference that was worldwide. It was called the Fatigue Super Conference. And it was like 50 of us doctors just, you know, we were asked. I spoke on chronic fatigue. I was asked to speak on that. I was like, sure. So, but, and I said, well, what's the integrative medicine doctor? And I see her on a bunch of supplements. And it was just as you said, it was so fragmented, which I see a lot. I was like, well, what is this other doctor? I mean, she ran some reasonable blood tests or some things missing that I'll fill in. That's fine. And she's like, well, one of my frustrations is that for the last year and a half, it's just been all she is about mind body, everything mind body. And I'm doing all the yoga and all the mind stuff, but she hasn't talked to me about anything else. So that's when she just sent me to neurology and rheumatology, and they said, well, maybe it's fibromyalgia, maybe it's chronic fatigue. And then I went back to her, and I said, what'd she say? She just gave me different mind-body treatments to do. And I said, well, I'm all about mind-body, but if you've been seeing someone for almost 18 months and they're still telling you, you need another
right.
take on it. And she's like, that's why I made an mm-hmm. appointment with you, is because that my body is not – it's gotten me better for my anxiety, but it hasn't done anything for anything else. So it's just very fragmented. It's, you get a lot of people that will just like take a functional medicine class or two, or, you know, and then they become experts in this, but they don't know it enough and in depth enough and enough training to where they can make it a much more solidified care. Naturopathic medicine does pretty good job of that, but it has its, you know, shortcomings too, is that
sure.
you know, you can get one person in a room with, let's just pick something, rheumatoid arthritis, and you get 100 doctors, 100 naturopaths in the room, you'll get 1,000 different ways to treat it, which isn't great. That needs to be distilled down to much more targeted therapies that are very effective and not cumbersome to the patient, you know, and not super expensive where they're just spending their life savings trying to get better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. One of the things I've talked a lot about in the past is we used to say to a chiropractor, every patient is a nail.
Right.
And the chiropractor is the hammer, right? So, and I'm not picking on chiropractors. I think chiropractors, some of them are great, and there is a time and a place for that approach. You know, the point is that, you know, most people, they discover a thing, an approach, and that becomes their specialty. And even if they're holistic, like you said, even if they're a naturopathic, they usually have this one thing that they think is like the holy grail. And so oftentimes you go to a doctor like that, and they're going to, you know, if they're a hammer, you're a nail. And what most people need is they need that deep dive into their whole situation, their whole history, their whole being to really figure out, is it a nail or is it a screw? Is it wire? Is it wood? Is it metal? Like, and to kind of get clear about, you know, what's going on, you know, what are the underlying causes and what are the right tools for the job? And so I have this vision for like the ultimate holistic doctor. And it's probably more what used to be, you know, in some ways hundreds of years ago, where you went to the tribal doctor and he knew everything theoretically. Of course, he didn't know everything, but he had this very wide depth of knowledge, he or she, and they dealt with it all. They dealt with the whole being, right? So like you said, you go to a psychologist, they're going to give you a pill. Well, and they're not taking into account how the different parts of our body and our being coexist, right? And so it's, you know, it's all very compartmentalized. And I think that's a big part of the problem. And I think we need a more holistic, uncompartmentalized approach.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's kind of one of your original questions or original points is that I have experienced being in both the conventional medical world and, you know, the quote unquote alternative medical world is that one of the things that is broken with our system, I love specialists. I use specialists all the time because they're great diagnosticians and I need their help because I'm not a neurologist, for example. You know, I might see a lot of MS or AL, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease and ALS, those kind of things, but I'm not a neurologist. I need a neurologist for especially if that person needs to go on certain meds. But the world of the general practitioner, family practitioner, albeit they exist, and those I have lots of friends that are that way, it's mostly that all they really do now is acute care. And, you know, for chronic care, oh, that's your thyroid, endocrinology, something wrong with your gut, gastroenterology.
Right.
Oh, something's wrong with it. You know, you see where I'm going with this.
Mm-hmm.
They don't manage the case like they used to. They used to be the focal point. And then if they needed to be like, all right, you know what, I'm going to send you to rheumatology. We got to get a workup, come back. And that's what we're going to do. They don't do that anymore. They're like, oh, rheumatology is handling that. I don't do that. And these specialists and now these subspecialists, right, they're so pervasive that now it's become so compartmentalized. And that's the paradigm. They see everything. They're not going to look at anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very sad state that we're in this medical world that is in the United States.
Yeah, you're right. It's a great point as well. So that to me, like that ultimate doctor would be this doctor who's very well-rounded in and of themselves, refers out as needed, but stays the case manager, as you said, the whole time. The coordinator right now, like you said, that doesn't happen. People are left to kind of do it on their own, and they don't know enough about health and medicine to do it on their own well. And so they're like going, bouncing around from physician to physician or expert to expert and trying to piece together their own story, and that's challenging.
It's very challenging. It makes the person worse too, because they got to take time off work. They're constantly in appointments. And what do you do when you go to the doctor, right? It's for me, like, if, you know, if I have to take my kids to the pediatrician, because I see kids and I can treat my kids for anything, but I don't do well childs, right? I don't see enough pediatrics to know all the milestones. What if they need an immunization, etc. I don't do those things, but I really get irritated when it's like I'm sitting in the waiting room for 10, 15 minutes, and then I finally get called in. Then I go to the exam room, and they basically get a height of vitals, right? Height and weight. Right. Then you sit for another 15 minutes, and then a nurse comes in and takes a little bit of history. Then you wait for another 10 minutes. And the doc, hopefully the doc comes in. Many times now it's the physician assistant, the nurse practitioner, and I'm not knocking. Those are great, great, great clinicians. But when you need that, they don't have a doctor's level training. They don't have 4 years of medical school and a 3 to 5 year residency. They don't do those, right, that level of training like that what I would do or someone else. So they're fine for some basics. But then if you do get to see the doctor, they're just trying to get out of the room to get to the next person. And right, there you just wasted an hour and a half, 2 hours of your day for 5 minutes of a really a face-to-face time. That is not an efficient use of that individual's time, and they probably didn't even get any answers anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know. So yeah. I've changed my practice. That's why it's like you get me for as long as you need, typically, and then we're gonna just solve this all together. And I'm gonna give you usually a couple options of what treatment you want to do. And I'm not heavy-handed supplement. I'm known as the great consolidator. I consolidate everybody's stuff because they usually come in on bags of things, right? The health food store, the neighbor, their friend, everybody's trying to help, but like you said, right, doesn't really have great training. They might be self-learned on a health book, or they read Dr. Weil's website, or they watch Dr. Oz and he says take some raspberry ketone or whatever.
Right.
And I'm like, you can finish all those supplements because you're not going to refill them. I'm going to consolidate them to a few once I actually find out what's going on. I need to know the etiology, the diagnosis,
right,
then we'll get you. And for the last 10 years, it seemed to have worked very well for me. I'm still here practicing.
Right. And where's your practice again?
It's virtual now. So I live in Gig Harbor, Washington, about 45 minutes south of Seattle. And I was in the Bay Area for 5 years. My wife's also a doctor. We had our practice together. We sold it to our associate. And I was doing a lot of telehealth anyway, because I was getting doctors or family, friends, people all over the U.S. were referring someone they knew to me because they're like, I don't really know what this guy does, but he sees really complicated patients, seems to get him better. You should go see him. Or I have friends that say, don't deal with tick-borne illnesses. And they're like, but he does. So it just was born out of necessity that I was doing more and more telehealth visits. Then when we decided to sell the physical practice and not deal with employees and, you know, all the headache of you know, and dealing with egos and also insurance in California. And, you know, we're just like done with that. I'm restructuring it. I'm going to just 100% telehealth, which has its drawbacks, right? I can't do physical medicine anymore. Like I can't do adjustments on chiropractic style adjustments. I can't do ultrasound or low level laser. I just have to refer out, and I can't do acutes because I can't listen to lungs or swab a throat. But that's okay because I can 90% of my practice before that was all chronic disease anyway, and those people are stable, and if they're not, I just send them to an urgent care or an emergency room. So now I just have people all over the United States and all over the world, even though physically I'm based out of Gig Harbor, Washington.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I was going to say, it's, as people always say, it's a global world, and it's true. And referral is one of the best ways to find good help in any area of life, right? And so it makes sense that now with the technology, you can see, you know, and work with this great doctor halfway around the world, whereas in the past you were limited to what was nearby or you had to travel, which of course many people can't afford. So I think that is something really to emphasize for everybody that, you know, there's no shortage of really talented, really skilled people who can help you with your challenges, and just get out of thinking that they have to be local. You know, one of my mentors taught me years ago, he's like, seek out the very best person. Don't go to the number three guy if you can go to the number one guy or woman.
That's right.
Like always go to the best. And now you can, especially when it comes to your health. Like, I mean, people prioritize generally, again, this is a general statement, people tend to not prioritize their health as much as they do other parts of their lives, like their homes, their jobs, their cars, et cetera.
Yeah, and, their makeup, their hair. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so it's like, you know, when you now you can prioritize your health, and it's easier than ever to be able to do that. One last question I wanted to ask you before we run out of time is, when you think about health, and you, again, you help many people with lots of different conditions. You mentioned some of the things earlier, you know, the importance of exercise. I think you mentioned green tea. What would you say, like just briefly, are the big secrets to, you know, to good health?
That's a good question. It kind of depends on the individual. Like in medicine, right, there's prevention, right? I'll just use dementia as an example because it's pervasive. People are scared of it, rightfully so. Nobody wants to lose their mind. Maybe their parents had it. So they come to me and they say, you know, I really don't want to end up with dementia, you know, Alzheimer's being the most common form of dementia. What can I do to prevent it? But I would say, and then there was someone who actually is in a disease state. It's like, what do we need to do to get them better and get their life back, get them back to their passions? But for me, I would say generally, right, it's most everything in moderation, right? You know, if you have that cigar once in a while, you have a cigar once in a while. Maybe you're celebrating your 80th birthday. I don't know. You know, to do those things to mitigate your probability of getting sick later in life. I like to have just general things like a whole foods, plant-based diet that's preferably organic. But if you can't be vegan or vegetarian, like I'm one of those, I've been a forced vegetarian many times by my wife. And I do need some, you know, and I'm not a big red meat eater, I've never been, but a few times, like once a month, I'm like, you know what, I am feeling depleted. I need some meat, you know, and once or twice, like, not even a month. It's usually like every couple months. I'm like, I really like this. Mm-hmm. And in Ayurvedic medicine, there's different constitutional types, and you should have different diets for that constitution, which then makes sense what I need. Mm-hmm. But I believe definitely in, you know, trying to do as much as you can for others, especially now, right? It's just such a scary, sad time we live in. Been a lot of reasons, right? Politics, COVID-19, the a lot of the hatred that's out. Like I can't even watch the news. It's so stressful. It's just so much anger. I don't do social media, anything like that. But I think doing things unto others when you can, you got to spend time outside. And there's this new, relatively new thing called earthing. I'm sure you're well aware because you're well versed. And there's a good amount of science behind it where you actually go outside and you're putting your feet on the earth, right? You're not sitting in your shoes on them. Right. And just taking that time to decompress and be with yourself, be with your family, be with loved ones. So really it's like positive, you know, outlook, doing things for others. Preferably a plant, you know, whole food, plant-based diet, not eating processed foods and going to McDonald's every day. It's garbage in, garbage out, right? If you put crap into your body all day, you're going to feel like crap, you know? And then there's also some supplements. I do believe that people, almost everybody, does need a high-quality multivitamin, multi-mineral complex. And I'm not talking one of these crazy six a day because – most of us don't get 7 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. And in the United States, most of the soil, for example, is deplete of magnesium. So even if you're a vegetarian, you're not getting all of it, and you're eating that, you're not getting certain minerals. I believe in some kind of omega-3, you know, 6-9 complex to help with inflammation modulation and eating fermented foods, keeping your gut in check, you know, make sure you have regular bowel movements. And if you love coffee and it doesn't interrupt your sleep, by all means, drink coffee. You know, if you love tea, the rituals. I think we need to do more, as you know, poignantly pointed out, more self-care than we have in probably, you know, since electricity was probably invented. Right. You know, since we have light now, right, we're not living on the farm. We can go to the grocery store and get whatever we want, whenever we want, and don't know what actually took to get to the table. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of really the synopsis, I think, for overall care. I wish I had, you know, the magic bullet of drinking the Worcestershire sauce every day, something like that. But I think just some basics, you know, really go a long way.
And you mentioned so many great points in there. If we had more time, I would love to dive in deeper into each of those. But the one I wanted to highlight that I agree really strongly with is the importance of discovering your unique, you know, you used the word constitution in referring to the Ayurvedic medicine approach, which, you know, it's totally legit, but there's other ways you can figure that out as well, right? Whatever you want to call it, I'm just going to call it constitution. I think we're all so different. And one of the major flaws with everything in human existence, just like you said, humans tend to be reductionists, like modern medicine. I think one of the main kind of flaws we have is we also think everything is the same, right? So we see humans as, oh, well, we're all the same. And yes, while there's many similarities, there's also many differences. And the differences can be quite significant from human to human, whether it's like, you know, thickness, length, shape of a bone, right, in the body, to the how the body kind of forms itself physically, like whether the feet rotate out or not. You know, I interviewed somebody recently, a biomechanics expert, and he was talking about that, how, as an example, you know, somebody has feet who rotate outward, and the, you know, the specialist, somebody else tries to fix that, tries to correct it wearing like braces or inserts in their shoes and so on, when the reality could be that person's body is just physically designed that way, you know, and it's, you know, you're just actually making more problems for this person. And so I think what you said about kind of understanding your constitution and eating specific to that, I think that's so important for all things, food, water, the amount of different things you need in your life, you know, so for instance, how much time you need in nature, I suspect how much vitamin D you need. All these things are going to vary from person to person, but we're used to norms. And I guess another quick note is a lot of the norms aren't even healthy, right? So like, I remember one of my doctors, he, you know, we were talking about testosterone and he's saying, oh, well, this is what the normal range is, quote unquote, but this is the normal amongst millions and millions of unhealthy people, unhealthy men with low testosterone. So it's normal across that group, big group, but you don't want to be part of that normal group. I don't know. There's just some things I wanted to kind of add on to what you had said about being aware of and paying attention to these things that are like the key, the big pieces, if you will, of optimal health.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very true. And that's the way everything, you know, is this movement in medicine where it's quote unquote evidence-based. Well, now there's actually a pushback amongst even very conventional groups like the American Medical Association, like what about clinical-based? Evidence-based medicine is what hospitals, for example, follow very strictly, is that you have these large trials, you get all these people, and then this is what the outcome is, et cetera. But you're looking at the – it's like a bell curve. You're looking at everybody under the bell curve. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But what about the outliers and in the alternative or complementary, whatever kind of world you want to say, you know, naturopathic, the people that we typically see are the people that are outside that bell curve, right? That are not underneath the area under the curve, because those are the non-responders. Those are the people that come see us. I don't typically see someone generally who has rheumatoid arthritis and is doing well on methotrexate, right? They're coming to me because they're not doing well on it, and now they're just pumped full of prednisone. And, you know, again, I'm not anti-meds. I prescribe prednisone all the time for short courses. But – and they're just – you know, or they failed all the medicines, or they had too many side effects of medicines, or they didn't work. And those are the people we typically see. And the same thing when it comes to blood laboratories. I have people all the times, you know, coming in for fatigue, women in particular, right, because men, we don't bleed every month. So they'll come in and they're like, oh, my – you know, I'm like, well, maybe you have iron deficiency anemia. And they're like, no, my doctor said everything was fine. I was like, yeah. Well, I'm going to run the blood test. And so what will happen is that the only thing they ever ran was a complete blood count, and they looked at a hematocrit and hemoglobin. But they never looked at an iron panel. So serum iron, ferritin, which is your iron stores, percent saturation, how much you binding sites you have for iron to get in. And it's low or low normal. And I'm like, you actually are – there's two stages of iron deficiency anemia. There's stage one, which is where ferritin, your iron stores, become low. But stage two is when your CBC changes. So your body will always rob Peter to pay Paul. It's always going to take things from everywhere it can to keep things as normal as possible, kind of like this homeostasis, you know, type of theory. And I'm like, you actually just aren't completely super anemic yet. You're just in stage one. You haven't.
Yeah. And that's such a perfect example you just shared, because that happens every day to tens of thousands of or millions of people all around the world on numerous levels. It doesn't, you know, you use the example of iron, but it could be any other thing. It could be testosterone. It could be thyroid, whatever. Doctors are saying your labs, because they're in such a rush to begin with, right? They look at the labs in 4 seconds and they look too high, like you said, surface level. They're not going deep enough. And it's good enough, on to the next. And then this patient now suffers the consequence of that. 2 years later, let's say, now they're in worse health.
Yeah, they're still sick, and what we were taught in medical school from the very beginning, which I thought was great, because I've talked to my conventional medical doctor family and my, and as I've gone through, now that I've been out in the real world, so to speak, for a while, I talked to my colleagues at conferences, and they never were told this. We're told, at least at Bastyr, where I trained, by a lot of the doctors, that you treat the person, you don't treat the numbers. The numbers are very helpful, but you look at the person. And this is like, and I'll give thyroid as the classic one because you brought it up, and that's what a lot of people can identify with. They have classic hypothyroidism. They're always cold. They can't lose weight despite adequate exercise and caloric restriction. They're constipated. They have dry skin. Their hair's falling out. They get a TSH run. Doctor says you're fine. Totally normal. You're like, well, but no, they're not. Or maybe the TSH is slightly high, so they give them a little bit of Synthroid, right? Some levothyroxine, which is just T4, and they give them the smallest amount. And then the person doesn't get better. And they say, well, your labs are fine. But look at the person. They still feel horrible. They could probably use a little more. Or look holistically at – there's this hypothalamic pituitary axis that actually where you can throw the thyroid. So there's constant crosstalk on the endocrine system. So for example, if someone's stressed out all the time for whatever reason, they have chronically elevated levels of cortisol. Cortisol actually inhibits the enzyme which makes T4, which is your inactive thyroid hormone, to T3, and that's what binds the receptors and makes basically the machine and the metabolic wheel turn. So if you can't convert from inactive thyroid to active thyroid because you're too stressed out, you're treating the wrong gland. You treat the adrenals, mm-hmm. the thyroid will actually fix itself, you know, oversimplifying it. But then, lo and behold, I've done it hundreds of times, people don't even need their thyroid meds anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But people just don't take – clinicians just don't take the time, they don't have the time, they don't want to do the time or whatever reason, and then people, they're completely inadequately treated, let me say it that way.
Yeah, well, thanks for giving that as another example. I'd love to actually, if you're open to it, do another interview at some point and we can dive deeper into some of these examples. We're just about out of time now, so I wanted to give an opportunity to point people to your website, so if they want to learn more about both your telemedicine practice as well as any resources that I know you've got resources on your Learning Center section of your website. So for everybody listening, if you'd like to check out Dr. Bourne's website, it's www.bourneintegrativemedicine.com. That's B-O-R-N, integrativemedicine.com. And I really appreciate you being on with me today. Super insightful. Like I said, I'd love to have you back again and go deeper.
Sure. Thanks for your time, Jesse. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, thank you.
So, what did you think? Did you find this interview eye-opening, informative, and helpful? I'd love to get your feedback. Please let us know what you think by emailing us at editor@livepainfree.com or give us a call, 800-216-4908. And while it's fresh on your mind, who do you know who could really benefit from what you just heard and learned? Go ahead and please share it with them. Our mission here is to completely transform the way people think about and care for their health. So please help us reach even more people. Everyone deserves the best chance at optimal health and wellness. And if this interview was shared with you and you are not a current Live Pain-Free member, head on over to our website, www.livepainfree.com, now and sign up for a free trial membership. I'm certain you'll find it one of the best investments you make in yourself. Thank you again for listening, and I wish you love, peace, health, and happiness.